I mentioned yesterday that once we start pondering the gospel passages from John, we're getting into deep water. And today's gospel is another example. This is not simple scriptures. This is not simply an account of a healing or a parable. This is a kind of developed argument. Maybe to help get into this method, you can think of a very popular form of entertainment in our own times, that is the courtroom drama or the crime investigation genre. You can think of many movies and TV shows where there's a crime committed, usually it's a murder, you know, murder mystery, and then someone looks like the guilty party, and then there's an investigation, all kinds of twists in the plot, and then at the end you discover the accuser is the guilty one. So I'm sure I can think of a half dozen movies that have this in it. Well, it's not actually that new a form of entertainment. This gospel is not entertainment, but it uses this kind of courtroom drama technique. Jesus is clearly marshaling his witnesses. Who testifies on his behalf? And he lists them. John the Baptist testifies on his behalf. The works he performs testify on his behalf. Or you could say the evidence. Look at the evidence. Look at the facts of the case. The Father testifies on his behalf. The scriptures testify on his behalf. So he's it like in a courtroom drama, he's gathering all the testimonies. What's the charge? We heard it yesterday. They wanted to put him to death because he was working on the Sabbath and because he was claiming to be equal to God. So working on the Sabbath was bad enough, but it wasn't usually considered a capital offense. But blasphemy, or claiming to be equal to God, that was a very serious offense to the Jews. Capital. So he's not exactly on trial. It's something like a grand jury investigation here. Is he guilty of the crime which we are suspecting him of? Jesus, in the course of his response, keeps on distinguishing between human testimony and God's testimony. He says, I'm not depending on what men think, or I don't rely on the human testimony, but I'm doing this for your sake, since you have to have human testimony, or you have to have evidence, here's all the evidence. Remember, the dramatic evidence that had just taken place was his cure of the man who was sick for 38 years. So that was still fresh in their minds. It just happened. John the Baptist was still fresh in their minds. He had made a big stir in the whole region. They did not, he mentions the Father, they didn't hear, or they may not have heard the words of the Father, although the Father spoke, remember, on a couple of occasions. Then at his last testimony that he calls upon is the testimony of the scriptures, which should have been very effective because they were experts in the scriptures. That was the very thing they were claiming to defend. And what Jesus successfully does here, just like in these courtroom dramas, the plot twists. He who was accused, once he marshals all the evidence, shows that the accusers are the guilty ones. The ones who are accusing him of being against God are exposed to be against God. They do not really have the love of God in their hearts. So now he's putting them on trial, and he says, I'm not accusing you. The one who will accuse you is Moses. This is brilliant, really, if you want to think of it, but why does he call on Moses? Because they accept Moses as the highest authority. He's the lawgiver. If Moses convicts someone, well, then that person is guilty. So Jesus uses their own method against them or their own paradigm against them. The one who will accuse you is Moses, in whom you have placed your hope. They were so dedicated to faithfulness to the law of Moses that if that testimony is against them, then they find themselves guilty. Very effective. But there's another twist in the plot, and the liturgy is brilliant in putting this gospel together with the first reading, which is about Moses. Not only about Moses, but about Moses and the guilt of his people. So it's another, you could say, another trial scene. God said, Moses is up on the mountain, and God says to him, well, go down at once to your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, for they have become depraved. Talk about a crime. The grave crime, the capital offense, is idolatry. Right after they're rescued from slavery in Egypt, they make this molten calf, this golden idol, and now they're worshiping it and sacrificing to it and praying to it, crying out, this is your God. Now, in the typical courtroom drama, the case often starts out with what looks like a clear case of guilt. It usually starts out, oh, this accused person is obviously guilty. Let's get this over with. And then only in the course of the drama do you realize, oh, it's not what it looked like. That's what Jesus does. You think I'm a blasphemer, but actually you're the ones who are not following God. But in the first reading, it is clear. It is clear. There's no doubt that Israelites are guilty of idolatry. They're caught red-handed. So God's accusation, it doesn't even need to be proven. There they are, worshiping the golden calf. Caught on video. You can see it right there. So that's not the twist. The twist is, instead of coming to a guilty verdict and giving the sentence, Moses steps in to defend the guilty. This is beautiful because this reveals God's own heart for those who deserve punishment. God, as we know throughout this season of Lent, he does not want people to suffer punishment. He doesn't want people to die in their sins. What he wants is people to turn away from sin so that they can be saved. It's the whole Lenten message. Well, here's Moses taking that gem from the heart of God, and in a sense, using it against God. Okay, Lord, these are your people. These are the people that you have saved. These are the people to whom you have promised that you will be their God and that you will give them a land flowing with milk and honey. Moses doesn't say they're not guilty. He acknowledges that they're guilty, but he raises the argument back into the heart of God and says, but who are you, God? Aren't you a God who is kind and merciful? Aren't you the God who chose these people in the first place and saved them? Don't let it be said that you are not a merciful God. Don't let the Egyptians say that you're a failure or that you're cruel. With evil intent, he brought them out. Don't let that ugly rumor rise up. Show yourself to be who you are, God of mercy and compassion, God of patience, a God who restores the fallen. And so he pleads, Moses, like a trial lawyer, pleads a brilliant case, not claiming that his client is innocent. He says, the client is guilty, but the judge is merciful. Beautiful, very beautiful. And now, this is not just a historical recollection. This reveals to us today who God is. We here are on trial. In this life, we are the guilty party. There's no doubt that we are guilty. There's no doubt that we deserve punishment. Moses accuses us. Our own conscience accuses us. The law accuses us. What hope do we have to be set free? The pleading of the new Moses, Jesus Christ. Jesus stands before the Father and says, Lord, have mercy on them. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Jesus not only pleads on our behalf, he offers himself as a sacrifice on our behalf. He ransoms us. Another twist of the plot. Not only does Moses turn God's own mercy against him, God turns himself, Jesus himself, God, the Word made flesh, takes on and embodies the very mercy of God and uses it to save the guilty. So this is what we celebrate in Lent. This is what we ponder today. Not that we're innocent, not that we deserve better treatment, but that God is extraordinary in finding a way to save us in spite of our guilt. He wants to save us, and he has saved us by the extraordinary power, the argument, the sacrifice, the testimony of Jesus Christ.